Hello, Anita. Good evening.
Hi, Ren.
Another show. It's show 12?
Yes, it is.
Great. Tonight we're privileged to have Mr. Jamie Scott Enyard. And he was in the Ambassador Hotel the night that Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And we're just going to try to get him on the line now. Scott, are you there?
Hi, Len.
Great. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
And our co-host, Anita.
Hi.
Hi, Anita. How are you?
Great. Great to have you here.
Good. Glad to be here.
Let's just go back and just give the listeners a brief overview. When Robert Kennedy was in the Ambassador Hotel, you were a young photographer there taking pictures. You ended up in the pantry?
Well, yeah. I was, 15 years old. I was on my high school paper, and I was assigned to photograph the victory speech of Robert F. Kennedy, as well as I was campaigning for Robert F. Kennedy out of his campaign headquarters here on Wilshire Boulevard. So I was, familiar with the candidate. I had met him before, and I was very familiar with the Ambassador Hotel because I had spent a lot of time there swimming in the swimming pool there with a friend of mine who I went down there with who belonged to a club there. It was called the Sun Club. It was like an athletic club. So I used to hang around, and I knew my way in and out and all the, different rooms and all the, doors and everything around the Ambassador Hotel. So we made sure to find out exactly where Kennedy would be. We were up in his room before he came down. We knew where the pantry was, and we were prepared to, sneak into the embassy room if we had to. It ended up that we got press passes, so we had full access to it.
Oh, so did you get to meet him beforehand?
I had met him the day before when he was walking around on the grounds there at the Ambassador. Access to it.
Oh, so did you get to meet him beforehand?
We would say hi to him. He was staying down at the beach at John Frankenheimer's house. And then they would have rooms there at the Ambassador Hotel sort of for official functions and things. So he would come there during the day and do things. His kids would swim in the pool and stuff. And then they would go back to the Frankenheimer house. John Frankenheimer dropped him off at the hotel, in fact, for this event, for the speech at around 5:30, I think.
Right, and then he would have what you would call a hospitality suite.
That's right. They had three rooms up on the sixth floor. They had two adjoining suites and then a room across the hall. And across the hall, they were set up with, an interview room. They had lights in there and everything. And so ABC News, and there were a lot of reporters that were assigned to him for the campaign. And so he would pop in and out back and forth across the room. And so we went upstairs. We took the fire escape stairs up. We knew what room he was in. And we would hang out in the hallway. And when he would walk back and forth, we would say hi to him or something and, just sort of poke our heads in the room. It was very friendly atmosphere. It was, there was no Secret Service at the time. There was a little bit of private security. You had a few guys that, sort of took care of him, Rosie Greer kind of thing, people who would, move people out of the way. But there was no official bodyguard sort of situation for the Kennedys.
Yeah, so it was probably exciting to meet him then.
It was very exciting. For me, it was an opportunity. I wanted to be, the big press photographer, and all the big photographers were there. There were about 200 photographers from all around the world, big guys from Life magazine, Bill Eppridge, people like that. And so, I had a press pass on. We could go anywhere. We'd go in the press room. We'd go backstage, mingle with these guys and, ask for, tips and advice and stuff and watch what they were doing. And so after we saw Kennedy upstairs, we went downstairs, and Kennedy was involved in three primaries. It was the California primary and then two others. And so they were waiting for the returns to come in on the other primaries, even though it appeared he had won in California. So he didn't come downstairs until after midnight. And we arrived there around 6 or 7 o'clock. So we were all over the hotel. And then finally, starting at around 10 o'clock, I took up position right in front of the podium, about 5 feet back from right in front of the podium, and just held my ground there until he came back, until he came down at about a little after 12 o'clock.
Then they had announced that he had, in fact, won.
Right. They announced that he had won. They brought him on stage. They brought his wife up on stage with him. He gave a speech, very exciting, everybody cheering and everything, and very casual speech. And I was impressed with how he, he didn't sit there and read some scripted thing. He related to the audience. He spoke about all the people, Cesar Chavez on stage with him, Paul Schrade from the United Auto Workers Union. And so he referred to everyone, was very comfortable with everybody. And then time came to leave the stage, and normally they would have gone off to stage left out to a doorway out to the parking lot. They were supposed to go off to an event at a nightclub called The Factory in West Hollywood for a victory party. And what happened, because Kennedy came on stage so late, he was advised by someone on stage not to go out into the parking lot, but to come back through and go into the press room where the radio guys were, because if he didn't go back and talk to the radio people and the print press people, he wouldn't make the morning papers. Because he had come down so late, everyone was behind schedule. So as he left stage, he went off to the right to go back to the press room instead of leaving the auditorium. And that's really what, you know, sealed his fate. Had he gone out the other way, he would have missed Sirhan entirely. So he went off stage and went off to what would be stage right. All of the press photographers and all the film photographers, and, you know, there was no videotape back then, so there was no cameras running. They all went off, packed up their equipment, and were headed for their cars. Because I didn't have the same kind of deadline, I followed the candidate and went backstage through these two doors where you go back to the kitchen area, and I followed Bobby Kennedy back into the pantry area, was photographing him along the way as we went. And so, that's when, you know, everything broke loose. I was about 10 feet behind him taking pictures, and he was being escorted by a security guard, Eugene Thayne Caesar, who was holding his arm. And as he was walking through and had his back to me and I was photographing, all of a sudden there were all these popping noises, and, you know, people were stomping on balloons and everything, and I had no idea what gunfire sounded like. I was 15 years old.
Now, I hate to interrupt you, so I'll just try to do this politely. First of all, you said that he was led by a security guard?
Yeah, there was a security guard, Eugene Thayne Caesar. There were a couple of off-duty guys from Lockheed who were private security force who were brought in. There were no police there. And so to help him get through the crowd, this guy, Eugene Thayne Caesar, was holding him by his right elbow and sort of escorting him through the pantry, sort of clearing people out of the way.
And
there was Rosie Greer, who was in front of him, kind of pushing the crowd out of the way. But Bobby Kennedy stopped there in the pantry area. There were all of these Hispanic and Mexican workers who were working in the kitchen who couldn't come out and hear the speech. And Bobby Kennedy stopped and spoke to all these people and started shaking hands and things. And I remember being impressed with the fact that, you know, he would stop, and after, you know, this long evening here when he could go off and party with his friends, he was spending time talking with these people who he obviously was concerned with, you know, being involved in the political process.
I mean, for those of us who have looked into it, we know the name Thayne, Eugene Caesar. But I was not aware that that's who escorted him.
Yeah, he was holding him by the hand, by the elbow, and moving along in the crowd. And in fact, when Kennedy was shot and finally ended up on the ground, he was holding Eugene Thayne Caesar's tie in his hand. It was a clip-on tie, and he had ripped it off. He had grabbed hold of his tie on his way falling to the ground and was holding it in his hand as he fell to the ground.
Yeah, right. Now, at what point were you taking photos? Right when this was happening?
Yeah, I was taking photos as they were walking. I saw him, you know, in silhouette, and he would turn from side to side shaking hands, and I was getting him at his profile as he was shaking hands. And then he turned one time to the left and was shaking hands. I remember all of a sudden he just dropped from the frame. He just fell. And so I followed him down, and there was all this chaos. I took a few pictures, and then people started falling backwards on top of me. In fact, Paul Schrade fell backwards and knocked me down. He was shot in the forehead. And as I fell backwards, I got up and jumped up on a table, which was in the corner of the pantry, and I continued taking pictures of everything that was taking place down there where Kennedy fell. But I thought he had slipped and fallen, or I thought he had fainted. I had not related to the fact that he had actually been shot at that time. Once I was up on the table and people started screaming and there were other victims, I've been shot, it became very evident that it was much worse than it was.
That's astounding, because for those of us who may not feel that Sirhan fired fatal shots, that means that everyone behind him, and you had clear photos of that.
That's correct.
You know, and more than one, a series of photos you were taking up to there. Approximately how many do you think you took?
It took about 18 to 20 pictures in the pantry area.
18 to 20 in the pantry?
Yeah, so during the actual shooting, there's probably 4 to 6 pictures as he's falling, and then the rest of them in the chaos afterwards as people are scrambling and moving around.
And at what time frame would you say from when you first noticed Kennedy falling to when the shooting stopped? How long would that interval be?
The actual shooting probably took place in a period of just a few seconds. It was very rapid, and I know that people immediately jumped. There's no doubt that Sirhan walked in that room with a gun and emptied it in the general direction of Bobby Kennedy. Whether or not he had blanks in the gun, whether or not any of his shots hit Bobby Kennedy, you can argue about, but there's no doubt, and there are a lot of witnesses, he came in there, he pulled his gun out, and he fired. The problem is that he was standing in front of Bobby Kennedy the entire time and about 3 feet away from him at waist level when all of the shots that killed Bobby Kennedy were point blank behind his ear, to his neck, and to his back. And that's where Eugene Thayne Caesar was standing. And Eugene Thayne Caesar pulled his weapon. And that's an interesting thing about once I was up on the table and all of this chaos took place, what I saw is I never saw Caesar pull his gun out and shoot Kennedy, but I did see him get up and his weapon was already out. And so he had drawn his weapon at some point. And so whether or not he accidentally shot Bobby Kennedy trying to return fire and kill Sirhan, or whether he intended to assassinate Bobby Kennedy, you know, nobody could tell at this point. But we do know that there was more than one gun in that pantry. We know by the bullet count, the official bullet count from the LAPD and the FBI, which is, you know, anywhere from 10 to 14 bullets. Well, that's, you know, more than eight, and there were only eight bullets in Sirhan's gun. The bullet that came out of Bobby Kennedy's head could never be identified as having come from Sirhan's gun. So we know that the bullet that killed Bobby Kennedy cannot be tied to Sirhan's gun, either in caliber and weight, nor in position in how it was fired in the pantry that night.
Right, due to the powder burns on the back of his head.
That's right. And it was a contact wound. And Sirhan was nowhere tall enough and nowhere near enough to Bobby Kennedy at that time to get in that position.
And this is astounding information because, like you say, if anyone looks into it, they find that the police recovered up to 14 possible bullets.
That's correct.
And then when they take out the ceiling tiles and the frame of the doorway and whatnot where the bullets were lodged in, these things have subsequently been destroyed.
And that's right. And the bullet that there's one bullet that was supposedly in pretty good shape that they could have tested was recently checked up at the archives, and it's been covered in grease. And once it's been covered in grease, you can no longer test fire the bullet. So the bullets have been moved, they've been, you know, altered, the evidence at the archives we proved during our trial, they changed evidence numbers, they took my photographs, evidence numbers 24 and 25, which once held a bullet and a shell casing, now all of a sudden were a proof sheet and a roll of film. So there's been all kinds of fooling around up there at the archives from the LAPD and the FBI, which came out in our trial. And the evidence has just been altered and changed in so many ways, and that trail of evidence has been so poor in terms of who touched what and who signed off on what, that the police have pretty much made sure that nobody can come to any conclusion other than the one that they came to, which was, you know, that Sirhan was their sole assailant.
Yeah, but this destruction of evidence is almost, it goes past the word malicious. It's you can't, it's like the Warren Commission. You can't say that they've made mistakes. They have purposely...
Well, no, they dry cleaned Bobby Kennedy's suit,
yeah,
you know, before trial. They took the wood door panels where bullets were fired and destroyed them because they said they wouldn't fit in a file cabinet.
This is
the kind of excuses that they're giving. They burned 2,400 photographs 3 weeks before Sirhan's trial in a hospital incinerator.
How many was that again?
2,400 photographs.
Right, and I think somebody said that was a stack about a foot and a half tall.
Exactly, of photographs, and they had no ID numbers. There were no recording of these photographs. And we put these police officers on the stand. Not only did they acknowledge doing this, but they said they did this on a regular basis. And so this is destroying photographic evidence before Sirhan even goes to trial, with evidence that hasn't even been logged in an official way.
So then would you say that, from what you're saying, then I guess you would say that this is a normal way that the police treat evidence?
Well, you know, when you talk about conspiracies, because my trial was never about any conspiracy, otherwise we never would have gotten to court. We kept it as a simple property case. The police department took my film, they didn't give it back, and so either replace it or pay for it. That's how we were successful in the courts. In terms of a conspiracy, you know, you can be part of a conspiracy without knowing you are part of that conspiracy. people can operate in a way because they're given orders in which fulfill the needs of a conspiracy without them consciously going, you know, hey, I'm a conspirator and I'm trying to do this to, you know, upset the government or whatever. And I think a lot of that took place in this case. There was this rush to judgment. You have to consider that we had had Martin Luther King killed. We had had John F. Kennedy killed. And so the order came down in this Bobby Kennedy shooting from Washington, from the FBI, within moments of the assassination, that we don't want another Dallas. And so they wanted to make sure, the LAPD, that they said, well, look, we caught the guy. We got him with his gun. Collect all the evidence that said this guy did it. And let's just get this guy to trial and get him into a jail cell, and we've done our job. And so they destroyed everything that didn't point directly to Sirhan having done it. And so they weren't so much malicious in what they were doing. They were really convinced they had the right guy. But in the process, they destroyed all this evidence of all these outside influences that would have told us why Sirhan was there and whether or not there were other guns or any other thing involved in this, and whether it was much a larger thing than just one, you know, crazed Jordanian immigrant with a grudge.
Yeah, but I wouldn't hold that opinion. I would, from what I understand from Operation Senator and testimony from some of the cross-examination of witnesses and how they browbeat people, I would say that there was several insiders that, like you say, were using people that may not have been known they were used, but this was an operation, a covert operation, which was rampant in, I think, L.A.
Right. I'm just saying at the level that I was operating, and at the level that we kept our trial and everything, we stayed away from all of that, and that's the only way we were able to get
right
through the court. Had we raised these issues like you're talking about, they would have said, oh, they're crazy conspiracy nuts, get them out of here. So we used basically their own tactics, clean police work, to bring this thing forward and expose enough of it. And so we were able to get into trial in 7 weeks of trial, put these people on the stand who had never been on the stand before, and like you say, willing or unwilling participants in a conspiracy, and get them to lay this story out and put it into the public record.
Right. So let's talk about your trial now. When did you first take the police to trial?
Well, what happened was I was taken at gunpoint at the hotel. Someone had told the police that I was taking pictures during the actual shooting, a woman named Joan Barr. There's a police report filed. So I was taken by police. I was held at the hotel. I was transferred to Rampart Station and questioned. My film and my camera were taken. And then they told me that my film was sealed for 20 years, that it was used as evidence in Sirhan's trial, and that I could not get to it until 1988. Well, in 1988, I waited all that time, and then I wrote letters and officially asked for my film back. One of the first things we found out was that there was no 20-year sealing of the evidence. That was just the LAPD saying that there was because they didn't want anyone to go near it. But no judge, no government body had officially sealed this evidence. The LAPD just decided that the public and the press shouldn't be able to look at this. So in 1988, everything was transferred to the California State Archives, and so through my letters, the archives were searched, and as a result of that, I got a letter from the California State Archives from the chief archivist, Mr. Metzer, stating that my photographs, not only were they not there, but that it was the opinion of the California State Archives that the police had burned and destroyed my film along with these 2,400 other photographs that were destroyed at the time. So it was then that I took legal action and actually sued the LAPD, the state of California, and whatever FBI, whatever entities we had to sue in order to get them to produce the records and produce the witnesses to discover where my film was.
And this is 1988?
1988. So we wound through the courts, through the appeals courts. We were thrown out on statute of limitations. They said you waited too long. Well, we waited 20 years because we thought the film was there. So we were reinstated by the courts so that our trial could go through. We didn't go to trial until 1996.
I have a quick question. Did you have that in writing then from the LA police that there was a 20-year limit on it?
No, they never admitted that. It was admitted in court, so it's in our court records, but the LAPD has never admitted to that fact other than on the stand.
Right, and to back up further 1 second, when you were detained and your film was confiscated, what would you describe that treatment like?
I was treated very well. I was taken along with, you know, Rosie Greer and George Plimpton, a lot of other witnesses who were there in the pantry. The police treated us, actually very well. I was 15 years old. I was all shook up and scared. You know, at that age, you know, the police department was my friend. in every aspect of my life. I'd never had bad dealings with them or anything. And so they were very comforting to me, and we're going to take care of you. And they called my parents and everything, and they questioned me at great length, and they gave me back my camera and said, hey, you know, we're going to take care of your film and everything. And then I went on my way. It was after that point when I came back to the LAPD even the following morning and said, gee, you know, I'd like a receipt for the fact that you took my film. And it was the following day that I noticed things were a little bit strange when they said, we had absolutely no record of you ever being here. And that continued on through that 20-year period where, you know, they were less and less likely to return my phone calls and, came from, oh, yeah, Scott, we remember you, to, you know, we don't know who you are after 20 years. And that's why we ended up filing the lawsuit, because of the way we were being treated.
And was that always by a certain spokesman? Did you talk to several policemen? Or
well, I spoke specifically with the police officers who took me into custody, and then specifically with the detectives of Special Unit Senator. And most of those guys retired along the way there. So as by the time we got to the 20 years out, I was talking to absolute strangers and whoever the political officials happened to be who were in charge of getting rid of this, which ended up being the city attorney's office. And that's where things started to get ugly, when the city attorney's office, not only the people who were working in that office started, you know, sort of ignoring us, but they then hired an outside law firm, this guy Skip Miller out of Century City, which they paid, you know, over $1 million to basically just get rid of our case. And that's when things started turning ugly.
Oh, hold it. So they paid an outside attorney?
Yes.
Not the city attorney?
That's right. And the city attorney's office has over, you know, 200 and some odd lawyers. Apparently none of them were good enough to fight this simple property case. So they hired this guy, Skip Miller, who is Mayor Reardon's personal attorney. He got the Rodney King cops off on their trial, on their federal trial. He got Nate Holden, a city councilman here, off on sexual harassment charges. He got Michael Jackson out of his child molestation charges, bought his way out of that. This guy's, you know, a real wheeler dealer and charges big bucks. And so they spent, you know, well over $1 million during our trial, close to $2 million now going into a second trial, in trying to attack us. And basically it turned from trying to find my film to personal attacks on me, and my integrity and what I do for a living, and me as a human being. And it got very ugly.
Oh, I can't believe that. $1 million. Okay, so we're in 1988.
Right.
And you're taking your first case. Who did you subpoena?
We brought in Thomas Noguchi. We brought in Ted Chirac, who's sort of the great granddaddy of conspiracy theories. We brought in, my father, photographic experts, absolutely everybody that was pertinent to this case. We even brought in Bernard Parks, because he was an assistant deputy at the time, and the judge refused to allow him in. Half the LAPD brass showed up on the day Bernard Parks was supposed to be on the stand. No one knew that he was going to be our new police chief. Of course, they knew within the government that this guy was up, and it would look bad for him to be on the stand and have to expose any secrets. So they moved mountains to make sure that Bernard Parks was not put on the stand during our trial. There was a tremendous amount of political influence that went along with this. And the city, what they didn't realize is they thought this was a simple property case and that they were going to, you know, just be able to crush me and get rid of me. And we were very well prepared for this trial and had all the research. The problem is, when they hired this guy Skip Miller out of Century City, he knew nothing about photography. He knew nothing about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. And they claimed at the beginning of the trial that there was no way we were going to talk about what took place during the assassination that night. All they were going to talk about was what happened to the film afterward. And every witness that we put on, we were able to bring out everything that happened that night during the Kennedy trial. Paul Schrade testified for us. He was shot in the forehead during this whole unfortunate thing. So we had a lot of people who were there that night, Ted Chirac, who brought to life exactly what happened in that pantry. The opposition brought in Bill Epperidge, Time photographer, Benson, photographer from...
Okay, you're going very quick. I've got to slow you down a bit. You subpoenaed these people. Did you bring in any of the detectives that did the interview you that night?
Yes, we brought in two of the detectives who were there.
So they were still on duty, or they retired?
No, they were retired. Shields was one of them. And these are the guys that we put on the stand, and they admitted that they took me into custody. They basically admitted everything all the way down the line.
So they confirmed what happened.
Exactly. They all they did was confirm what happened. We had so many documents out of the California archives that the LAPD had turned over, and part of the problem was during the trial was if we couldn't produce the officer who signed these documents, the other side would claim, well, that's you know, how do we know that's from the LAPD? Well, the LAPD put it in the California State Archives and said it was from the LAPD. But we had to actually bring in the people who signed the documents, many of whom were retired or dead, in order to bring that in. So they stripped our case early on of documents that stated he was in the pantry, he was on the table, he was taking pictures during the shooting. A lot of that never got to the jury. We had to prove that through other means. But fortunately, we had the actual tape recording of my interview with police. And we got that from the California State Archives, and on that taped interview, I draw a map for the detectives as to where I went, where I was, and what I was photographing the entire time. And once the jury heard that, and that was confirmed by the officers who were there, that's pretty much what sealed the fate and why we won that jury trial.
Okay, so that was in 1988?
That was in 1996 that the trial took place.
Oh, so it took... Several years?
20 years for us to get to...
No, but when you first started in 1988, it took another eight years or whatever.
That's right. 96
so
we finally got to trial.
You got a jury trial.
We got a jury trial, and we won that jury verdict. We won over $500,000 from the city.
So, can you tell me a little more about the final verdict on this one?
Well, the final verdict, they found that the LAPD had had altered and changed evidence and that they had not been honest and that the value of this film was tremendous. And that the other thing that was interesting was that during trial, just before trial, they claimed that they found my film. They claimed that at the California State Archives, they found my film. Now, they went up there on their own. They took a police officer with them who was with me the night of the assassination. And all of a sudden, they claim, we've got a roll of film here that's Scott Enyart's, and we've got a piece of paper here signed by the police officer who took him into custody, a police report that claims that this is his film. And so we insisted that these documents be brought, and this film be brought to court for us to examine. Well, it was brought to court, and on the way to the courthouse, the courier was robbed. He was robbed just out of LAPD jurisdiction out there by the airport, and this poor courier was sitting in his car, and all of a sudden some guy, you know, slashes the tires of his car. He pulls over. They reach in the back, and they steal the briefcase with the film and the evidence in it, and this guy shows up at court with nothing. So they conveniently created film. They brought it down to court, and when it came time to get it to court, it conveniently disappeared.
Wasn't this the second attempt to bring the film to court?
And this was the second attempt that they had to bring it to court. The first time they attempted to bring it to court, the courier brought it in, the police courier, and the package had been opened and examined. And so the judge said, you know, this is spoiled evidence. Send it back. And so they sent it back to the California State Archives. It was re-inventoried, and it was sealed again. And the second time it came out, and the second time it was stolen on its way to court. It's just ridiculous. And then we put this officer on the stand and presented this document to him that he had signed. And we asked him, well, when did you sign it? And he said, well, I don't remember. And we said, well, did you sign it, you know, 20 years ago, or did you sign it yesterday? And he could not remember. He just wouldn't talk.
You mentioned Skip Miller before and all his connections. Now, I understand, perhaps you could correct me if I'm wrong, that he placed a call to find out what car company.
Oh yeah, his office called that courier company. They wanted to know when the courier was arriving, what car he was renting, what color the car was, and what the route was that he was taking to the courthouse. So, you know, the suspicious stuff just goes back, you know, incredibly, you know, toward Miller and his boys.
I've got to cut you off here for a second. Can you go over that again? How did you find that out?
We put the courier on the stand, deposed him on videotape and played it for the jury, and they stated that Skip Miller's office called the morning the package was supposed to arrive, and they wanted to know what time the flight arrived. They wanted the description of the courier, and they wanted to know what car he was renting and what color the car was. What route he was taking from the airport to the courthouse, which is just ridiculous.
That's beyond unbelievable.
Yeah, we talked to the courier, the owner of the courier service, and he says, you know, in 25 years of delivering packages, he says, the only questions I ever get are, when's it going to get here and how much is it going to cost? Nobody asked me what the route is or what color the car is. And so this was tremendously suspicious, and of course it took place in Culver City outside of LAPD jurisdiction, so we couldn't say it was LAPD cops. And, you know, same thing happened when we went to appeal. When time came to appeal this, all of a sudden the entire clerk's record disappeared from the courthouse. It was stolen. The entire record, the clerk's record of our trial, had been stolen from the courthouse. And so this had to be reconstructed through attorney's notes and things like this for the appeal process. So, you know, they've been playing fast and loose with the facts through this whole process. Another thing that happened was during jury deliberations, Skip Miller contacted the jury foreman, took him to his office, and took a statement from him while this guy's an impaneled juror during deliberations.
Isn't that strictly forbidden?
It's strictly forbidden, and Skip Miller was then taken before the California State Bar. He was charged with this crime. He was found guilty of it. His defense was that, he had the First Amendment. He had the right to talk to anybody that he wanted to. Then he blamed it on an associate. He claimed that another lawyer in his office had looked up the wrong statute and given him the wrong information, and that associate was since then has been made full partner in his law firm. If someone had actually caused Skip Miller to jeopardize his license, he would have been found, you know, dead in the parking lot of that law firm. But instead, this guy's promoted to full partner. So Skip Miller was found guilty by the California State Bar of what amounts to jury tampering, illegal contact with a juror. And so it was just outrageous. And his punishment was originally the prosecution wanted to take his license for at least 2 months. And he negotiated a deal because he's Mr. Hotshot. He ended up with 1 day of ethics training class was his punishment for contacting a juror during deliberations during a trial.
It's just
outrageous, the abuse of power. It's just truly offensive the way this thing has gone down.
Well, you're one of our quickest speaking guests, so I've got to keep backing you up.
Sure.
So pardon me about that. Now, you mentioned the word appeal. So the first trial, the jury found in your favor.
First trial, jury found in our favor. They were found guilty, I believe it was on 14 different counts. And so we were awarded over $500,000 from the city. And so basically, since supposedly this film had been destroyed, there was nothing for them to hand over or anything like that. And so we just waited. We went into the appeals process, city spending more and more, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of city money.
Well, what you're saying is the city appealed the decision then.
That's right. City appealed the decision.
They didn't want to pay.
They didn't want to pay. That's right. And so despite the fact that they'd spent, you know, 2-3 times that in court, what the judgment was, they were not going to pay me one dime. And so we went into the appeals process. And in the appeals process, they used the fact that they claimed the jurors had preconceived notions about the LAPD. One of the jurors had mentioned the members of the LAPD have, you know, routinely taken advantage of people in the minority community in terms of falsifying evidence. Which ends up being true out of Rampart Station, which is where I was taken, in fact. And so the appeals court overturned our decision based on juror misconduct, the juror misconduct which was inspired by Skip Miller contacting the jury.
So they overturned your award.
That's right.
On juror misconduct when he had been charged? Had he been charged?
That's right. He had been charged.
He had been charged and found guilty. One day.
He had been charged and found guilty of illegal contact with the jury.
And I hadn't heard a word of this in the news.
That's right. That's right. It was all buried. You know, nothing came out. And so we are now facing our second trial. And so we're in preparation now to go back into court and fight this battle again. And so that's the decision that I have to make right now as to whether or not I want to go back into another 7 weeks of trial. And the kind of abuse that we've been put through and the stress on my family and finances and everything. And so, you know, they've been talking about, you know, settling out of court and there are negotiations going back and forth. But it's the same old dirty tricks, you know, the same old, you know, ugly, you know, trying to silence me, you know, well, if we settle, then you can't talk about it, you know, this kind of thing. And so we're back up there for round two.
Sounds like quite a fight you've got on your hands.
Yeah, and, you know, you're talking about 30 years out of my life here. It's something that, you know, I really didn't want to do. You know, I just wanted my film back. you know, at every step of the way, I turned to my attorneys and I go, you know, I don't want to go to court. You know, I don't want to do this. And they kept going, hey, you know, we're winning. You know, we keep winning. You can't back out now. And if we hadn't won at every stage of it, you know, I would have walked away a long time ago. But it just became so offensive, the way that we were being treated. Originally, it was about getting my film back. Then it became, you know, how can you treat me as a citizen here? I come voluntarily and give you my film, shut up about it for 20 years, go ahead and use it, don't ask for anything, don't ask for anything back, just return my film. And instead of saying, hey, let's go look for it, and, you know, thank you, you're a good citizen, they start attacking me and my character, and I was forced to see a psychiatrist before trial. They claimed that I was, you know, they went through my school records and claimed that I was, you know, a liar and you know, basically a liar and a thief. You know,
I got to cut you off here. So they were attacking you personally?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of questioning would be brought on?
I was forced to see a psychiatrist. They claimed that because of, you know, it took me a long time to learn how to read in elementary school or something, that I couldn't tell time and I was some perpetual liar, and so my testimony couldn't be trusted. I had to see a psychiatrist and was forced to take all kinds of sort of humiliating, insulting, you know, examinations, you know, do you hate your father, you know, did your dad kill your puppy when you were a kid type questions. Over and over again before trial. Now, of course, this was all thrown out by the judge, but I still had to go through it, and I still had to hire my own psychiatrist to prove the opposite side and everything. And this was just done by Skip Miller's office as a way of wasting taxpayer money, in a way of intimidating me and my family and trying to stop me from going through with this process.
It's unbelievable. You mean you were forced by a court order to see
a
psychiatrist ahead of time?
Yeah, to be examined by a psychiatrist.
For claiming a recovery of a property?
That's right. That's right.
You couldn't get your lawyers to get that turned
down?
The
only way I could do it was by going through with the examination and proving that it was false.
God.
That's how ridiculous this system is.
You know, I think just hearing you say this, you've basically answered a question that I had. That being, what would be gained by the city for drawing this out a second round instead of just settling with you?
Well, exactly. And the, you know, they've never even offered a settlement. You know, I might have gone away for, you know, three rolls of film and an apology if they had asked. But instead, because this guy Skip Miller has no motivation to have this thing settle, you know, every time he goes to them and he says, hey, we're going to win, you can't let this guy win if he wins. The other thing is, if we had won, it would have changed the law in terms of how they handle evidence. They would have had to actually ask your permission to take something out of your house. They couldn't just come and grab it. They would have had to take care of it, and they would have had to give it back to you. And if they didn't, they would have had to pay you back the value of it. And up until now, the LAPD does not have that restriction on them. And this was evident, you know, right after the riots here in Los Angeles. The police went door to door confiscating videotapes and still pictures that people had taken of people during the riots. And they wanted to use this stuff so that they could get, you know, people who were looters and ruffians on the street and put them behind bars. But they went door to door confiscating this stuff with no warrants, just taking this away from people. And, you know, it's one thing if you come to my door and you say, hey, you have some evidence here we could use in trial. Can we give you a receipt for it? Can we borrow it, make a copy of it, and give it right back to you? That's one thing. But to come in and say, give us your film, give us your scrapbooks, you know, give us your personal stuff, we're going to use it in trial, is absolutely, you know, against everything, you know, that I was raised with in this country in terms of, you know, right to privacy.
So in that case, did the jury make recommendations? Like sometimes they do, you know, meaning that the LA police is going to have to be responsible?
Exactly. As a result of our trial, the statute would have been changed in terms of standard of care, which now is that the LAPD has a slight standard of care. What does slight mean? You know, throw it in the trunk of the car, you know, and maybe it's there when we, you know, get to the station. It would have elevated that standard of care to reasonable. In other words, they would have had to take care of it, give you a receipt for it, and make an effort to return it to you and store it, you know, in a locked up fashion. And so that was one of the reasons why all this weight came down on my trial, was that we have to defeat this guy. If this guy opens this door, this is going to, you know, create this is going to shackle the police department in terms of their being able to investigate, crime here in Los Angeles, just because you'd have to ask, you know, somebody's, you know, permission before you knock down their door and take their, you know, their scrapbooks and home videos.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that there is evidence in your trial that Bobby Kennedy was killed by someone other than Sirhan, and you had photographic evidence of that, and they would stop at any length. Because what you're saying about the changing of the law in L.A. County, about how they handle evidence, that wouldn't explain that all the records of your trial being stolen.
That's right. Exactly.
So there's one way to look at it in an apologist's point of view, saying, well, we had to bring this weight down because we don't want to change, we don't want to handcuff our policemen for making their illegal searches, right?
Right.
But, you know, and give people a basic right of, like you say, a receipt. So if somebody does have a videotape of something, they want it for the news, or they want to put their hands on it. But I think it's a deeper, I can't think of the right word, but subversive.
Oh yeah, an effort to silence, you know, and that's really what came through in this trial is, you know, that they don't want, you know, a citizen speaking out like this, that they don't want me to have this venue, you know, this right. It was a very offensive process, you know, once, you know, Skip Miller and the city, you know, turned their tack toward me personally as opposed to just dealing with this as a, you know, simple property case. You know, they towed my car away out of my driveway, and they didn't return it. They lost it. It's a very expensive car, so pay me for it. Instead, it turned into this personal attack on me and whether or not I was a photographer and all these other things. You know, ends up, you know, just bleeding, you know, me and the city dry of money and accomplishing nothing. The other thing is, you know, they got the press banned from our trial. Court TV wanted to cover this. There was all kinds of news coverage, and they got the press thrown out of the courtroom. We came in right after the OJ trial. And so they threw the press out of our trial, and so we had only very limited press coverage. People were allowed in there basically with a pencil and a paper to cover this trial, and all media now is pretty much electronic or you know, at least audio. And so they banned all of that from our trial, and you know, that was ridiculous. If we go back in a second time, it will not be banned. We've already talked to Court TV and a number of other people that want to cover this trial so that the people see what's going on, you know, behind closed doors.
What was the excuse for banning? Was it just the O.J. thing?
Because of what it had, all the fallout that had happened with the O.J. Simpson trial, they claimed that they would have to sequester the jury and they couldn't, you know, it would taint the jury pool and all this other stuff. All that's been overturned, you know, since then. But because of all the furor, you know, following the O.J. thing with everybody camping downtown and everything, we lost a lot of ground there. And, yeah, exactly. It's absurd. The press was thrown out.
I was under the impression that 2 weeks ago that something was up.
That they've offered, they're offering, you know, settlement. They want to go into, we have a judge who is a pro-settlement judge, and he would like us to negotiate. So things are going on between the attorneys and between the city right now as we speak in terms of whether or not they're going to come to us with a reasonable settlement that doesn't include gagging me, saying that I can't speak about this or I can't write about this. And I don't want to put the city through another trial. I don't want to put the city through the expense of it. I don't want to put my family through this or, you know, have to put my friends
I wouldn't worry about the city's expense because it seemed like they didn't care about it at all.
Exactly. They didn't care about it at all. But I do, you know, as a taxpayer, I don't want to see them run up, you know, another $1 million, $2 million behind the scenes. You know, if this was out in the open and everyone could see what was going on, that would be one thing. But to just have this behind the scenes, you know, money machine, you know, running the tab on both the city and myself and no information getting out, you know, I'll fight this thing in the press like I have before. You know, and that's what I told them. I said, this second trial will be about Rampart Station, which is where this took place. And this will be about Skip Miller, you know, who was found guilty by the bar of illegal contact with a juror. This is going to be a much bigger case than just, whether or not they lost my film. It'll be about film being stolen. It'll be about court records being stolen, and I'll try this on the courthouse steps if I have to, no matter how much they gag me behind closed doors.
It must be very hard for an average citizen to go after justice in this. I mean, these trials cost a lot of money, even if you don't have the super high-priced lawyer.
That's right. That's right. I've been fortunate in that I've had the resources, and I've had a lot of friends and attorneys that have come forward here, and political activists, guys like Paul Schrade and stuff. Ted Chirac and Paul Schrade, who've come forward to help me with this. And so, I've been able to muster, a lot of forces behind me. But, to do this again, with just to know we're going to go back. And if we go back to the appeals court, we go back before the same three judges that threw us out the first time. It automatically goes back before those same guys.
There seems to be something wrong with that.
Yeah, there's something seriously wrong with that system.
What you need to get out in public.
That's right. So I'll be fighting this, like I am on your show, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on here because these are the forums in which we really get to get the points across. I'm not gagged by my attorneys or the judge telling me I can't talk about this, that, or the other thing. We get to bring out all the issues, and the public gets to decide. The public is not stupid, and that's the way we're treated. We're treated like we're idiots, like we're children, and that we're not capable of handling this information. And we certainly are, and we're capable of, after all these years, and we're entitled to a review of what happened that night, to review of this evidence before everybody is dead. I was 15 years old at the time, so, we've lost four or five witnesses who were there that night in the pantry there. And so before all this evidence and before all these people disappear, we're entitled to a clean airing of this and just get the information out there. I've never, claimed, conspiracy or 10 bullets, this other thing. I just want the facts out there. Let the people decide, for themselves, come to whatever decisions they want to on this, but we are entitled to that information. And now with, internet and so many more people out there, investigative reporters, people like you doing a job like this, we're going to get that information out there to the public where it belongs.
Well, as hard as it's been on you in a court of public opinion, this sort of case makes a big difference. It might not get into the mainstream media, but people take an interest when leaders are assassinated, and that doesn't die down in just a couple of years.
Well, that's what I found, and it's been very encouraging when, people like you call me up or, people will stop me in the courthouse and say, I've been following this case, because it takes tremendous effort, to go out and research something like this. It doesn't show up on the cover of the Los Angeles Times. You got to dig for this stuff. You've got to find, people like you on the air or, these little journals that come out or go on the internet or go research the archives yourselves to really get the information and make up your mind for yourselves what's taking place here.
Now, you mentioned that you had the coroner, Thomas Noguchi, on the stand. Now, can you tell us what he had to say about the gunshot wounds?
Well, Thomas Noguchi stated that these were contact wounds and that he was not satisfied that they had come from Sirhan's gun, and that had he had my photographs, they could have entirely changed the results of his autopsy report. He would have had the information of what took place behind Robert Kennedy during the shooting, and when all three bullet wounds entered from behind Bobby Kennedy, he said that this information would have been really the basis for bullet trajectories and who was where and firing what and at what height and what distance in this case. And so he was adamant in saying that had he had access to these photographs, this could have very well changed the outcome. He would have had that much more information to add to his autopsy report.
And as I understand, there's a lawyer fighting for a new trial for Sirhan right now.
That's right. Lawrence Teeter has been battling away, and we've given them access to a lot of our court files and things, and vice versa. They've fed us a lot of information. They have Lynn Mangan, who is a tremendous researcher who's done a lot of just real good research going up there to the California State Archives. She discovered this evidence being opened up, numbers 24 and 25, evidence being moved from one book to another. She would go up there and photograph the logbook, and then go up there a couple of years later, open up that same logbook and photograph it, and it had been changed. Here's something in the California State Archives from the LAPD, and all of a sudden someone's going up there and altering this evidence. It's just been absolutely shocking. So there's a tremendous amount of stuff. There's no doubt that, Sirhan walked in there and emptied his gun. How he got there, why he was there, whether he was hypnotized or not, whether or not his gun fired the bullet that actually killed him, these are huge questions. You know, you may have some guy in there who's, you know, certainly he's guilty of going in there and starting this whole thing, but he didn't kill the guy. Maybe he didn't fire the bullet that killed Bobby Kennedy. Maybe none of the bullets he fired hit anybody. The point is we just don't know right now. And so it's a tremendous injustice. I'm not out to, you know, to free anybody, but I'm out there to free our minds and to find out what information is there. And then whatever happens, happens.
Well, I think one telling tale of when you talk about being hypnotized is that Sirhan has no memory, I think, up until this day, of really what happened.
And that's an important thing because, you know, Sirhan would sell out anybody to get out of jail. This guy's pretty unhappy. If he could remember anything and go, hey, that guy did this, that guy did that, and he could get a little chunk knocked off his jail time, he would do it. He desperately wants out of jail. So in that sense, you know, I have to admit he has some credibility when he says, I don't remember, because this guy would turn in anybody to get out of jail.
That's pretty amazing. And there hasn't been any press, really, about that effort.
Right.
You mentioned his lawyer or legal team. I forget. Did you say it was actually his lawyer?
Lawrence Teeter.
Yeah.
Is the lawyer who's handling the case. Well, the press stays away from it. Los Angeles Times, you know, we've got a one newspaper town here. And everybody, you know, other than that, you watch, you know, 2, 4, and 7, maybe Channel 11 for a little bit of video news. People don't dig deep for that, and that's why radio news, and that's why a lot of these alternative journals and things like that really make a huge difference when you get into these deep political issues that aren't, you know, the eye candy of the day. You know, they're not the, you know, I turn on the news today, and it's another, you know, guy out running the police,
yeah,
you know, for 45 minutes instead of sitting down there and analyzing some hard-hitting story that affects all of us, like, you know, who's killing our leaders.
Yeah, or completely subverting the justice system.
That's right. That's right. Instead, we're distracted by, you know, bright, shiny objects here like a bunch of squirrels. You know, the people here, you know, are deserve a great deal more here. The people out here and the generations, I've got kids now in college, and their level of understanding and their level of research that they demand before they make a decision on something is such a higher standard than there was when I was a kid. That it really hurts me to see the media pandering to the lowest common denominator.
Especially the lying that you see.
Yeah.
I mean, today the recent news is what they think the flight, TWA Flight 800.
Right.
Is now some kind of fuel tank.
Right.
And there's all sorts of people that are calling out for none of the eyewitnesses were called to testify.
Yeah.
And I think there's over 50. And there's, I think, a Commander Donaldson, a few other people. I mean, I won't get into that whole...
That's right. What are they afraid of?
Yeah. The thing is that they're so used to getting away with it, and they've been able to pull the wool over our eyes that they, when, you know, Ted Turner sold out CNN to that conglomerate that bought it,
right.
That was the last time they had any independent news reporting.
Right.
And they totally, I think, as April Oliver had mentioned, that it's been confirmed that, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think 80 people from the Pentagon.
I think it was 30.
30?
30.
30 people from, black operations,
right,
were in there in the newsroom doing training on how to color the news.
Right. No, we're in the midst of a very quiet revolution, you know, and what you're doing here on the internet and the small radio stations and, you know, the independent, you know, magazines, the zines that are coming out and everything. This is really the future. You know, they can't control, information. They really can't put a cap on it here. And as much as, you know, MP3 files, you know, are stealing copywritten music, at the same time, that same types of technology, when you apply it to news groups or to transferring information or immediate response from the scene, from people who really know what's going on, real witnesses and stuff, I think that, you know, we're on the verge of something, you know, tremendous here in terms of liberation, in terms of information being taken out of the hands of the big publishers and the big networks and being put in the hands of people who can, you know, sit, you know, literally in their garage and disseminate news.
Oh, you've seen our studio. Well, I'd love to agree with you, except that what we're up against is a very well-financed machinery,
yeah,
and it takes people doing low-key. I mean, if we had a little wireless station, you would call this, you know, pirate radio or something, transmitting,
right,
to, you know, 12 watts. Luckily, we're able to broadcast, but even better, we're able to archive the shows.
Yes.
So we may have a limit of how many people can log on at one time. that we don't have any limit of how many people can listen to archive shows.
That's right. Scroll it away, and, you know, it's like Fahrenheit 451. You know, everybody memorize a book.
Yeah.
Well, I do have to agree with you. I think that actually the information age that's coming on us right now is probably taking a lot of people by surprise. I know for myself and Len, and for a lot of people around here who are more into the computers, we were into this years ago, and I know I couldn't have foreseen how fast it would grow and how quickly information would change hands.
Well, what's terrific is the older generation, and I'm talking about the generation above me and me to a certain degree, the fact that I don't understand it is tremendous, you know, because so much gets done, you know, under my nose and under the nose of the old establishment, that by the time that this thing is out there and wired up and everybody's on it, they won't even know what hit them.
Exactly. I'm very optimistic about that myself.
Yeah.
We have some gloomy topics on here, but the bottom line is the information gets out and people are aware, and that's what makes change.
The information sets you free.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, hopefully. But another reason is that, you know, there is a few people that I've wanted to speak to, and you were one of them, and I don't see any news coverage, I don't see anything, so it's been up to me actually to go out and make a call and say, can I talk to you on
That's
the air,
right.
You know? And, you know, on the same token, I'd love to talk to William Pepper, who just did the Martin Luther King trial in Memphis, and once again, I'm scouring the internet, and I can't find any articles. I find one or two kind of rather uncomplimentary articles from Memphis. And, of course, there's this famous Gerald Posner, right?
Sure.
I hate even bringing his name up. So, Poisner, I should call him. But, you know, on this, you know, topic of film and the Robert Kennedy assassination, I think the only conclusion that I draw is that there is they're worried about uncovering what really went on and making that, you know, even more in the mainstream.
Right.
And with that, have you ever been approached by Oliver Stone at all?
Oliver Stone has kept track of what we were doing through the whole thing, because JFK was produced during the prep time during our trial. And so we've been able to get documents back and forth between, and they've fed us a number of documents and things. So, yeah, that's all a real closed circuit. I've been approached by many people to do books and TV movies and things like that, and I've always, you know, wanted to keep this trial a very pure thing. I've never taken a dime for an interview or the use of a photo or anything like that. Until this thing finally concludes, you won't be seeing, you know, a movie or a book or anything like that until we wind through the courts and come to a reasonable conclusion. You know, once that happens, then we'll probably go to that next step, you know, starting with, I've been taking notes, obviously my journals and things for a book, and we'll see what happens from there. But, you know, I want to be very careful about this, exploiting somebody's death, you know, for profit has always been a very ugly thing, and there's a very fine line that you have to tread there. In terms of whether or not it's worthwhile to get that information out. And you get someone like Oliver Stone, who has at least a background and at least a, you know, a strong, you know, political point of view and a certain purity to it, whether you agree with him or not, has that certain power to get that message across. And so if I find that kind of a medium and it's not exploitative, then we might take that to another level.
Right, because you had mentioned you had been approached by Court TV.
That's right.
So is that something that you would get, if they did cover the trial, you would get any compensation?
No, we'd get no compensation at all.
So,
basically,
but this is going to be costing your side hundreds of thousands of dollars, though.
Well, Court TV comes in there, and then they basically put their cameras in, and they cover the trial. The cost to me is the cost of you know, putting on another offensive. And so whether or not that's worthwhile, we've already won our jury trial. Whether or not we want to do that, and whether or not we want to cause the city to cough up that much money in their absurd defense of it, we'll just have to see if that's the best forum for it. Sometimes, you know, the best forum for it now is you know, on the radio with guys like you, or, you know, maybe in book form. And that's what I'm having to mull over now at this point in my life. You know, I've put, you know, a quarter of a century into this battle. It's time for me to sort of wrap this thing up and move on to the next one.
Right. But saying that, I think that if you did have financial resources behind you, if we made this a little more public, I think there's a lot of people that would be surprised and actually want to know what had been going on especially in your case when you have firsthand evidence of mistreatment of something as simple as just, like you say, wanting your film back,
right,
to turning into personal attacks,
yeah,
psychiatric reviews,
yeah,
and on. I mean, you must have more stories that you want to talk about.
Yeah,
in
that sense, you haven't heard the last of me yet. Whether or not the best forum for that is another trial or something else, you know, that's what I've got to figure out. You know, we're just reining everything in now, and you know, looking at the damage that this has caused, and the emotional turmoil that this has put all of my family through, and everything. You know, my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time this thing happened. We've been together since we were 13 years old, and I didn't put her on the stand in the first trial, and she's all, you know, ready to go now in the second trial, going, "Hey, put me up there. I want to, you know."
Oh, that's great that you have support.
You know, I want to let these guys know what really happened, type of a thing. But that's exactly what I don't want. You know, I don't want to drag my family into this and stuff.
Well, there's other people like Jim Garrison and
you saw through that. You know what a toll this takes, and you know, when we're watching that movie, that was hard for me because you know I became this monster in my house. You know, obsessed with these other things, these bigger issues, and you know, the main thing is, you know, to let something like that be affecting how your family moves forward over that amount of time. It's a big sacrifice. You got to be careful.
I mean, you could debate that. I would say that really it should be worth it. You're trying.
Well,
to
that's the thing is, it's been worth it so far.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, going, do I want to wind up and do this thing again at this point in my life? You know, that's why I've got to say, gee, maybe there's a better way to do this. Maybe it's a book. Maybe it's a movie. I don't know if it's necessarily the arena of the courtroom where all the benefits are on their side because they have unlimited resources and attorneys ready to go. Is that where I want to fight this battle?
Yeah, you do make a good point because this is already being brought out in court. The public eye, if you could make a movie book, or actually probably a movie would reach a lot more people.
That's right.
That would probably get to the people's ear a lot quicker than another court case.
Yeah, we've already fought it in the public arena. We already won, and we have that record. I have tapes here of the entire 7 weeks of trial. You know, 7 weeks of trial, they put mass murderers away in 2 weeks.
Well, but I have a question for you then. With all the official court records being stolen, are your records, I can't think of a better word than legitimate?
Oh, yeah, we have the audio recordings of every day of court. So that's what we had to do was we had to reconstruct through these audio recordings, had to re-transcribe everything
right,
in order to put back
law.
Together
yeah.
what took place in that courtroom for the appeal. So it's a tremendous amount of work, but got a box here with, you know, about 100 2-hour tapes in it. That'll be the next thing for me to sit down and do is at least that's within our control and the record is clean and clear and we can basically convict them with their own words.
Right. Was there something that that stood out in the first trial when you had these people and you were able to, as you said, pull out evidence about the actual shooting, never mind just the property issue, that maybe isn't as public knowledge?
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, the LAPD was not there before the shooting took place. They didn't arrive until over 20 minutes after the shooting took place. That there were three guns in that pantry. There, Sirhan had a gun that held 8 bullets. Rafer Johnson took that gun away from Sirhan and put it in his pocket. The murder weapon supposedly left the Ambassador Hotel in his pocket. There was another FBI agent who had a gun who was with the Kennedy family, the same guy that was involved with Ted Kennedy during the rape trial of his cousin. So that we know that there were three guns in that pantry that were waved around and possibly fired and emptied. All of them left that pantry out of the control of the LAPD. Rafer Johnson handed over the gun to the police at the hospital where Bobby Kennedy was dying. There were at least two guns booked into evidence at Rampart Station. I've seen autopsy photographs where Bobby Kennedy is on the autopsy table, and right next to them they have the murder weapon. Well, we've blown up that murder weapon, and it does not match the murder weapon that was presented at trial entered by the police.
Well,
so
that's astounding. So you're telling me that they have records of two guns?
They have records of two guns, conflicting records of two guns, different sight, different barrel length. entirely different weapons, both hold 8 shots, and I've had these analyzed by weapons experts, and, you know, you can't dispute a photograph that, you know, has Bobby Kennedy's shoulder in it and the supposed murder weapon, and then the official court records from Sirhan's trial, which show photographs of the gun booked into evidence by Wolfer, who was the ballistics expert, and those guns don't match. They don't match by serial number, and they don't match by profile and description.
Dan, that's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah, people should know about this.
Okay, so it's one thing to say that people are just doing their job and they believe Sirhan is guilty, and probably, like you say, on the ground level, most of them did feel that way, but at some point, somebody had to be making a concerted effort to bury evidence.
You bet.
And that's not a theory. When it comes down to it, you have actual evidence.
That's right.
So you let people say what they want. I know a lot of people who get involved in research get called conspiracy theorists, and they get
right,
you know, rightfully offended when they're dealing with facts.
Sure. And a lot of this took place in those hours, you know, late at night, between when the LAPD was in control of the scene, as weak as and as inefficient as that was, and then the guys from Washington start showing up, and the FBI starts calling up and calling the LAPD, going, "We don't want another Dallas." So, you know, there was one investigation where the LAPD tried to get everything under control, and you got a bunch of ground level cops doing the best job they can on night shift. And I don't begrudge those guys for, you know, making mistakes and doing the best they can with the resources that they have. I do blame Mayor Sam Yorty for not having police at the Ambassador Hotel protecting Bobby Kennedy to begin with. I blame Sam Yorty for the police department calls up, and on the recorded call from the Ambassador Hotel, the LAPD has to ask Senator who, and then it has to ask directions to the Ambassador Hotel, which takes up 19 acres 5 blocks away from Rampart Station. So, you know, that's one lousy part of the investigation. But this second wave that comes in from Washington, the power of the Kennedy family coming in there not wanting another Dallas, the power of the FBI coming in there wanting to control the situation, and with all the information they had on the Kennedys and the political ramifications of what may come of this, that's when things got ugly. And then the formation politically of a special unit senator who was put in charge of that, a lot of, you know, really ethical, hardcore cops coming in there trying to contain an investigation that is already out of control. A bunch of guys who, you know, if you'd left them alone, probably would have done a pretty good job, but you got the FBI coming in there, poking their nose in, CIA, going, "Hey, we want to come in here and examine this evidence." They go in and examine the evidence, and they leave, and there's one gun missing, or there's, you know, a piece of paper missing or something like that. And this entire investigation and this entire situation is just chock full of stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't that actually make it then more like Dallas? They wanted to avoid Dallas.
Exactly.
But it seems
that
the parallels just keep getting stronger.
Right. They created it with this rush to judgment, you know, and that, hey, we grabbed the guy. He had the gun, you know. There's 70 people in that pantry. The gun's empty. The guy's dead. You know, who could argue with that? Sam Yorty came out, you know, and claimed we got the guy the next day. You know, for, you know, in a simplistic way, you know, that's the other thing. The public wanted that conclusion. The public did not want another Dallas. They wanted a simple explanation for this.
Well,
when you got the public wanting that conclusion, and then the government gratifying that need of a grieving country, Martin Luther King killed 2 months before that, that's what goes into the American consciousness, and that's a hard thing to erase.
I imagine it's pretty difficult to go from Leave It to Beaver and I Love Lucy to the startling political reality of having your leaders murdered.
That's right. That's right. You bet. And it was very upsetting generationally to, you know, the generation of my father's generation of going out there and fighting World War II, you know, and then my generation of, hey, you know, I'm going to go to Canada. I don't want to fight in Vietnam. And now we have this third thing here, you know, my children, you know, two generations from having to fight a war, being able to look back and go, gee, well, you know, Grandpa went to war and you decided you didn't want to go to war. And, you know, now where do I lie here somewhere in the middle? Where is my government? You know, where are my boundaries? You know, where are my moorings here? Where's my compass, my moral compass?
Yeah, but then when, you know, the kind of subversion here is that if you lose faith in the government.
That's right.
You know, there's some kind of subversion going on there. But when, and these aren't my words, when that loss of faith is actually justified, that's the real deep subversion. That,
you bet.
Not only can't you trust the police, but they already had somebody, for instance, drop off Sirhan, have him hypnotized, he was just there to pull out a gun, and somebody else working under the guise of the Lockheed Corporation, you know.
Actually, that leads me to a question. You mentioned earlier that that Bobby Kennedy was late for his speech.
Right.
Do you know why?
He was late because he did not want to come down and announce victory without having these other two states come in and be assured of that victory. You know, today you go to the polls, and, you know, I remember during, you know, the elections when Bush was being elected, I'm on my way to the polls here on the West Coast, and they're announcing on the radio who won already.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, what's the point of voting type of a thing? And so in this case, we had a much less accurate system. So Bobby Kennedy was sitting up there in his hotel room until the returns came in, until he was sure he had, I think it was Montana, California, and one other state. If he had gotten that block of three, then it was pretty much a shoe-in that he was the candidate.
Now, you did sort of mention that earlier, but what I found odd was that if he had been earlier, he would have taken the other route. Does that mean that somebody who knew he was going to be late and take the other route had Sirhan there? Or is it, I mean, not knowing how the Ambassador Hotel is laid out,
yeah,
would it have been easy just to ferry him there when they saw what direction Kennedy
was
going?
Well, that's the thing, is that I think that, you know, Sirhan had showed up at other events where Kennedy was and missed him. So I think that, you know, Sirhan, was he hypnotized? He was sent out and, you know, sort of given a map, and he's going to be here, here, and here, and you try and get him. So I think Sirhan was pretty much on his own once he got to these locations. And I think it was just a matter of luck and happenstance as to, you know, in the last few minutes of a campaign or making these decisions on the run, are we going to go to the party, are we going to go to the press room type of a thing. It was just a matter of then coming up with the most likely circumstance in which he would run into them. But I don't think that there was any collusion between Kennedy's people and the people directing Kennedy in terms of directing them towards Sirhan. I think that that was a lucky stroke for the Sirhan forces and an unfortunate move of a disorganized campaign on Kennedy's part.
Yeah, actually, I was even wondering if perhaps somebody outside the Kennedy campaign might have suggested they take that route, or that's pretty much determined.
From what I understand, it was like this throughout the entire campaign. It was like, should we do this? Should we do that? It was his campaign was a much looser, you know, what's best for the people, what's best for the crowd. Oh, so-and-so is here. You forgot to shake hands with so-and-so. And he would backtrack and go do that. That was one of the frustrations in keeping track of Kennedy as a candidate, was that he was so headstrong in terms of, you know, he would stop and he would get involved in something or go, oh, gee, I promised somebody I would, you know, come over there and say hi to them or something, and he would throw the whole thing off. And so I think that the randomness of that and the lack of security made him, you know, a target that if you went out there two or three times, eventually you were going to bump into him, and that's what happened in this case with Sirhan.
Now, I have a question that I may want to correct you or myself on. I was under the impression that you were telling me about just entering into the pantry, that it was the maitre d' that actually took Bobby Kennedy by the arm.
The maitre d' was on his other side. You had two men taking him by the elbows. You had the maitre d'.
Okay.
And then on the other hand, you had Eugene Thayne Caesar, who was the security guard. The maitre d', Carl Euchre, knew the way through, and the security guard had the official, you know, the gun and the uniform and was assigned to Kennedy to get him through. So you're exactly right. One was on each side of him moving him through that crowd, and that's why Carl Euchre was the first one to grab the gun, was because he was standing facing toward Eugene Thayne Caesar when this happened, and Sirhan came up between the two of them in the middle.
Yeah, right. Okay, then. Well, thanks. When you cleared that up, because I remember just when you brought that up, I was thinking, oh, something's wrong here. I don't know how to
ask
the
question. It's like, you know, Kennedy really is being led to slaughter here. You know, he's got two people leading him directly right toward where Sirhan is hiding.
Right, and, you know, there's some people that feel that even though Eugene Caesar had a gun out, he might not have been the one who actually pulled the fatal shots, and if somebody else was right behind him.
Right.
And your photographs would have showed that.
Exactly.
You were there.
The photographs would have shown that, you know, and that's what's a shame about this whole thing.
And seconds before, and then for the rest of the night, this person isn't there.
Right.
Who was that right behind him, and then he's gone.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties here, you know, too, in terms of a conspiracy, is that there's really no way that you can connect Eugene Thayne Caesar and Sirhan as being both part of the same conspiracy.
No, but you wouldn't, right?
I'm sorry?
You wouldn't.
You can't. Yeah, they were totally different. You know, Eugene Thayne Caesar was way off here, a Wallace supporter, you know, totally, you know, out there to the right. And then Sirhan here, you know, RFK must die, and, you know, against him, you know, approving the sale of jets to Israel and everything like that.
Wow, yeah.
And if Sirhan and Caesar were together on this, and they planned to kill Kennedy at this point in the pantry, if you and I were going to kill somebody, would you say, okay, I'll get behind him and you get in front of him and we'll both shoot at him and basically be shooting at each other?
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's a pretty lousy plan. So you can't connect them politically, you can't connect them logically in terms of a plan, but then again, what forces outside of the two of them got them into that same situation at the same time? It still assured the death of Kennedy, which was the ultimate objective.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say that from my investigation of people in the JFK assassination, these are skilled professionals that have taken months in this kind of clandestine covert work. That,
yeah, and that's why it's important that, you know, people understand that, you know, you can be a willing participant in a conspiracy without knowing that you're part of it.
Right, and you know, like as you even mentioned, did Sirhan's gun contain blanks? Maybe he was told, it's just a warning, you're going to scare the guy, don't worry about it.
That's
and
right.
They hypnotize him, and he doesn't, you know, there's a lot of area for discussion here and many points of view, but I think one main point that you can't escape is that they would not be fighting tooth and nail if your photos didn't show something, and the destruction of evidence, and like you say, a foot and a half of photographs.
Right.
2,400?
Yeah, 2,400 photographs.
2,400 photographs, right?
Yeah.
Burned
in a hospital incinerator.
Right, and you have evidence of the tampering with the archives, grease on a bullet.
Yeah.
Phony logs. I mean, that isn't trying to, at that area, that isn't trying to protect the L.A. police from having to draw up a new law about how they gather evidence.
That's
and
right.
How they keep it. This is about complete corruption and keeping down any effort to expose it.
Yeah, and this comes from, you know, the chief archivist and the people working at the archives. You know, it comes from LAPD officers. It's not coming from outside, you know, wacko conspiracy nut people. It's coming from people being put on the stand who now look back going, I was an unwilling participant here, and I was taken advantage of here, and I was duped here. Here's my story. And so that's why, you know, a lot of this has tremendous credibility, and we were very happy to get guys like Noguchi and things like that on the stand able to tell their story, because, you know, Thomas Noguchi was not allowed to testify at Sirhan's trial. The LAPD didn't like what he had to say, so the chief coroner, the guy that examined and determined the cause of death of Robert F. Kennedy, was not allowed to testify at Sirhan's trial.
As I recall, I think he was threatened.
He was threatened, exactly, and so we were able to get him on the stand for the first time and let him testify in terms of what his conclusions were of his autopsy and the death of Robert F. Kennedy for the first time. This takes place in 1996.
Right.
This is ridiculous.
And these records have now been stolen.
Well, we have the recorded records, the official court records. There's two records. There's witness testimony. That's intact. The clerk's record is everything that takes place outside of the ears of the jury. Motions that are brought up to the judge, discussions in judges' chambers, things like that. So all of the testimony is intact and is clean. That was not taken or altered. But the clerk's record, all of the judge's instructions to the jury, Skip Miller being admonished for talking to the juror, and that was the other thing, is the reason why those records disappeared was because all of the testimony against Miller in terms of how he behaved in that courtroom that would have convicted him during his bar trial, that's why those court records disappeared, was so that there wouldn't be anything to prosecute him with.
So that got him off the hook.
That got him off the hook. You know, so he used, you know, our trial and those circumstances, and they were able to engineer the disappearance, the mysterious disappearance of these records to, first of all, to destroy our ability to respond to the appeal, as well as clear Miller in the investigation in which he was found guilty anyway. But he would have been found guilty, you know, much more harshly had they not been able to destroy these records. So it's just fishy from day one.
Yeah, unbelievable again.
Yeah. You know, exactly. Eliminate the press coverage. You know, cheat and lie and use all kinds of underhanded ways to hobble our opponent here. We don't have the facts on our side, so let's attack him personally. Closing arguments were just, you know, brutal. My daughter and my wife were in tears over what this man was saying about me in the courtroom. It was embarrassing, but in effect, his attack on me personally is what made the jury rule in our favor. The jury saw right through this. And
so was there an exit poll of jurors?
We talked to the jurors afterward, and as much as I would like to give credit to my attorneys and say we won this case, I have to admit that Skip Miller came in there and he lost this case. He lost this case big time by taking the tactics that he did and by attacking, you know, a citizen who did nothing but offer up his film and cooperation for 20 years and simply came back after 20 years and said, you know, could I please have my pictures back? I think the jury was truly offended by the way we were treated. And they only heard, you know, a microscopic portion of what took place because, you know, so much was hidden from them until after the trial.
Right. And you have audio record of some of that.
That's right. We have audio records of the entire trial, all of the testimony. Everything that took place in front of the jury, we have audio recorded, everything that went into the record. It's what took place sidebars and judge's chambers and in conversation between counsel and the judge that from time to time that we had to reconstruct. And we were still able to reconstruct that, but the point is that we didn't have the transcripts. This is specifically what Miller said at this time. This is specifically what the judge said at this time. And so it made prosecuting Miller that much more difficult. And it made our appeal process, that much more expensive and had little gaps and holes in it. We were able to be, overturned.
Has anyone come up with an explanation for how the transcripts could vanish? Be stolen?
No, and we talked to people, and they said, you know, it's possible, you know, during a trial, you know, it's big files and everything, you'd lose like a file, a particular envelope, or you know, something gets kicked under a file cabinet, or you lose a couple of things, but you don't lose the entire clerk's record from an entire trial. The records keeping people, attorneys we spoke to, other judges said that's absolutely unheard of. This took place during a clerk strike at the courthouse. So they took advantage of a time in which these things were relatively unguarded. And we were described by other attorneys that, you know, you just go into the file room and you say, I'm looking for something on so-and-so case, and they give you a pass, and you go back there, and you can move things around willy-nilly and do whatever you want, basically, and if there's not enough people there to watch or whatever, you can get anything, you know, you can move an elephant out of there. So they managed to make sure that the entire transcript of the clerk's record from that trial just disappeared, an entire cart, you know, three shelves full of documents, just gone from the courthouse.
Three shelves full.
Yeah, three shelves full is how it was described. Just disappeared. They said, you know, yeah, you lose a file here and there, you know, that happens. But they've never heard of a case where the entire record disappeared from the courthouse.
It's just staggering and eye-opening and unbelievable having this discussion with you. The scope.
Yeah, you know, we really walked into something in this case. You know, for me, it was real simple. You know, I wrote a letter to the police chief at the time, Daryl Gates. You know, please, sir, you know, could I have my three rolls of film back? You've had 20 years. And it just escalated and moved into this big, huge thing. You know, I am in no way, you know, some, you know, political activist or some guy with a bone to pick with the LAPD. I've never been arrested, never been in jail, you know, never had any conflict with the city whatsoever. Relatively mild-mannered, you know, in terms of my politics and my political efforts in the past. You know, my wife and I live here in Santa Monica, and, you know, we feed the homeless, and, you know, we do what most other families do on a nice, you know, sort of low level of political involvement for people of our age, very typical. So to be drawn into something like this, I was brought into this thing kicking and screaming, but after a certain point when they turned on me, when they hired Skip Miller and this turned from, hey, let's go look and, you know, try and find your film to, hey, you vile creature here, they referred to me in court documents as lurking in the kitchen with Sirhan.
Oh, with Sirhan.
Lurking.
Lurking in the kitchen with Sirhan. You know, where did this come from?
No, I have one other question that I forgot I wanted to bring up. Had you heard or have anything to offer about the supposed woman in the polka dot dress?
Oh, a woman in the polka dot dress is interesting. I have a photograph here, in fact, which the LAPD kept undercover, which shows Kennedy at the podium speaking and Sirhan standing in the crowd, and the woman in the polka dot dress is standing right in front of him, and he's got his hand on her shoulder.
You're kidding.
No, and so there are so many photographs like this. You know, there definitely was, you know, a woman in a polka dot dress or close to that description, probably a number of them. The Sandy Serrano tape, which you probably heard, where they...
browbeat.
Browbeat, just this hideous, horrible way, and that was one of the things. When that tape was played for me, that sort of turned the tide for me on the LAPD, in the sense that, you know, they weren't all, you know, nice and dealing above board with this. And so, you know, Sandy Serrano was threatened. She won't speak. She was accused of stealing funds from, I think, Gloria Molina's campaign or something like that, some ridiculous trumped up charge. And the LAPD came to her and basically told her, well, you can either go to jail or not go to jail, but you can't speak about the Robert F. Kennedy case for the rest of your life. And she cut that deal. Now, you know, that's not legal. You know, that's not the way you do things. So she's been, in effect, silenced. She's been threatened and silenced in this. So you won't hear from her again. And this woman in the polka dot dress, supposedly running from the scene of the crime, we shot him, that's just another thing that makes conspiracy people sound crazy, and there's enough evidence there for them to go in and actually come to a conclusion on this, and they won't do it.
Well, there could be a conclusion that she's the one who brought Sirhan.
That's what I'm saying, you know, but that will never be explored because they've made it out to be this, you know, the one key witness, Serrano, is this lunatic, you know, who was stealing, who was this, that, and the other thing. And, okay, we silenced her, and, you know, just like so many others, they're just going to wait these people out until they die, and then they can bury this whole thing.
Well, I would, we're probably going to wrap up in about 4 minutes here, but I would say to you that when you first heard the Serrano tape, you know, as myself, the reaction was, I can't think of a better word than unbelievable.
Yeah, absolute shock. This visceral,
yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, you're doing this to somebody? This is like absolutely horrible because, you know, I was treated with kid gloves. You know, they, you know, gee, thank you for coming in and your father's here. You know, we're going to take good care of your film and your pictures and stuff. Are you okay? Can we get you a Coke? Can we get you, you know, a cup of water? You know, kind of thing. And then to realize that women like this, you know, brought in like that and then, you know, browbeaten and treated like that, and, you know, it's a cancer, and, you know, and you're a Catholic and Kennedy was a Catholic, using all these horrific things to weasel out of this, you know.
Oh, yeah. Think of his spirit looking down on you, and think of the Kennedy family, and this is what they want. How can you go against them?
That's right.
And this
type of thing, you know, just unheard of.
Well, I would offer to you that when you're thinking of the funds of L.A. County, then think about that, because if they were spending over $1 million to bring in this hotshot lawyer when they already have a staff that's fully qualified of over 200, as you may have mentioned.
Yeah.
They have an agenda here.
You bet.
And, you know, that money may not even be coming out of L.A. County, maybe coming up higher up the chain.
Right. And that's one of the things that we want to expose, is we want the records brought out. You know, let's see the billing records for this trial.
Oh, yeah, that would be perfect.
You know, let's lay this out and you know, let the city council justify that.
Well, I tell you one thing. Are you familiar with that April Oliver?
No.
She did the Operation Tailwind on CNN.
Right.
Which exposed nerve gas in Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
She recently had spoken to us, and she went back. She was fired, as you may have recalled now, and she sued them for wrongful dismissal, saying that she had covered the story for 9 months. They had, you know, boxes and boxes of statements, videotaped, interviews, and they went back against Admiral Moore, who, and others who said that they misquoted them, and she won a settlement, and of course now she's not allowed to say a word about it.
Right.
And the last we've heard, though, is that you know, she has a new car and a new home, and her family's doing well, but she just has refused to comment, and that's something that I'm glad I got to speak to you ahead of time, because I hate to hear that a year from now you did get a settlement that at least was worth your 20 years abuse, and of course the abuse having to go through the abuse from Skip
right.
and others in that department, which should have said, listen, we've lost it, or it's been destroyed accidentally by well-meaning people,
right.
or you know, listen, shut up, take the buyout. We know we did wrong, but, you know, so at this point in time, for what they put you through, I think you do deserve either, you know, something or you know,
well,
make something worth it. If you write a book or do something or make
yeah.
a movie.
Even in settlement, we've always come forward and said, you just pay what our costs are, you know, no damages, no nothing. You just pay what my court costs are, pay my attorneys, and I'll walk away from this. And they don't even have the dignity to do that.
Well, I would withhold that offer now.
Yeah, no, all bets are off right now.
Yeah, it seems you've had enough damage lobbied against you that you have a right to at least see this through one way or another.
Yeah, as long as they can't silence me in terms of my being able to speak out and lecture on this and, you know, bring this out to other people and now take the records that I have of this trial and their own words damning themselves and bring them out to the public, that'll satisfy me, you know, quite well.
Now, as you said, this trial wasn't meant to actually expose what happened with the assassination. It was really about your film.
Absolutely. We engineered it specifically as a property trial, you know, property loss case, and
well,
that is why we were successful through the courts.
And I was just going to say, and that is actually, maybe you didn't intend for it to go that way, but from the exposure perspective for the case in general, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to owe you thanks in the future just for actually getting the history on record, some of these facts on record and publicized, because as you said, you know, people like the coroner weren't even able to testify until they had another venue which wasn't directly involving the assassination.
Right. Yeah, that's what we're hoping for.
Yeah. And at worst case, I know, yeah, I'm not talking about myself, for instance, but I produced a CD-ROM for Colonel Prouty, which had documentation, 9 hours of audio, video, etc., and that may be something that maybe in your future that you decide, well, listen, I can make a CD-ROM now with the size that you can put on a disc.
That's right.
In which you can detail what happened to you, and I don't think that Skip could do anything against that because he's already been found guilty of jury tampering and wrongful.
That's right.
You
that's
know,
right.
So,
all we do is go by the records and you know, and lay it out there. And that's what I'm hoping to do is distill this room full of boxes of, you know, court documents and audio tapes and videotapes and everything and bring it down into some, you know, manageable form and putting it out there so people can, you know, just
yeah.
for themselves.
I think there's a lot of interest, you know, and
yeah.
Well, look, what I'll do is in the next year or two, I'll get your address and I'll mail you my CD-ROM. And,
terrific. I would love that.
And in the meantime, we just wish you luck in your effort.
Oh, great.
And, you know, I don't know what support we can do, but we will have the show archived, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to be interested. This is a really fast-paced and eye-opening interview.
Great.
And I think we just skimmed the surface of it because... you know, just judging by your comments, there's so many instances of wrongful, complete, malicious handling of records in almost every avenue.
Yeah, it's hard to keep focused, you know, and going in one direction on this because you get pulled off to the side so many times, and that's what I have to keep clear is, you know, what am I really after here and keep on a true course. And so, you know, it's always a pleasure to be able to do things like this because we're not bound by the restrictions of the courtroom and we have enough time to actually lay out the story and everything and people get a chance to think about it and come back to it.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a further interview down the road and see what outcome you have.
That'd be great.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having you here.
Good to meet you, Anita.
You too.
Okay, well, thanks again for being on, and we'll keep in touch. Hope things continue to go well for you as your first trial ended up.
That's great.
I can't believe the city had the nerve to even appeal it. But
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
Yeah. All right, then. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Lam. Thank you, Anita.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was unbelievable.
Very enlightening.
Well, I think we're up an hour and a half. We only went to go in an hour, but we could have talked for 3 hours.
I suspect so. It would be great to have him back, though, once he's gone a little bit farther, see how
Yeah, I think we can look into it and have more questions, because I'm sure there isn't. He had things at the top of his right at the tip of his tongue that he could have answered. You know, even as I forgot, and he must have gone through all that testimony firsthand. So there's something to look forward to for a return visit.
It is indeed.
Okay. Well, episode number
12
in the books.
In the books.
Okay. We appreciate everybody who listened in, and if you have any comments and suggestions for guests, we'd be only too happy to entertain them. All right, Anita.
Good night, Lynn.
Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah.
Bye, Nara.
Good night.
Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.